In this podcast, I'll give you some of my reflections and thoughts on a book I've read called The Discovery of Time. It's edited by Stuart McCready and published in 2001. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Now, in general, I don't get to talk very deeply about science or in detail when I read or hear something. I know a lot of background information. I don't get to discuss it in detail. So what I'm going to do is rather boring. I'm just going to go through a few pages that I've noted, things which are unusual, which piqued my interest, and I'll go through it, and you'll see how, as a scientist, I'm picking it up. And at the second half of this podcast, I'll go through some of the other information which wasn't actually covered in the book, something that you add to it, which adds a lot of interest to it. So going through the book, I know it's rather boring to do this. Page 14 of the book, they talked about how the Egyptians had time, and you'll know those obelisks. They had their sundials. And based on the Babylonian calendars, the Babylonian counting system, which is base 60, they divided their day and night up into 12 hours. Now, the issue with this is that the 12 hours were 12 hours of night for no matter how long or short the night was, and 12 hours of day for how long and short the day was. And this meant that the day was began at 6 a.m. and ended, had a peak around noon, at high noon, and finished at 6 p.m. They didn't use those terms, of course. But this, I found rather interesting, that the hour was a variable hour. It was the division which was more interesting. And, of course, you can all imagine in the Northern Hemisphere, this would be far more dramatic with the poor Laplanders and people with 24 hours or continuous night and day would be in a bit of a fix here. The interesting thing is that this idea of divided time and time actually went way up into the Middle Ages. So it was pretty interesting to hear that. The next point I want to do is on page 84. It's Euctemon's Parapegmes. Now, Parapegmes is actually a stone. This is in the Greeks, and the Greeks had a stone, and they had the 365 days of the year. And we know, or it's 365.25, so every couple of years, every 4 years, we add an extra day. That's called intercalculation. That's where we add something extra to get our calendars in line. Now, interestingly, just as an aside, we do this at the moment, as the Earth's rotation doesn't keep absolute pace with a full 24-hour day. As defined scientifically, we have to actually add leap seconds every couple of years as the Earth's rotation changes, and we speed up and slow down. With global warming, the ice caps melting, we've got more weight on the equator, and so we are slowing down quite significantly due to that. But getting back to Euctemon, they have a stone sheet, stone pegs, and you advance the peg each day, and the next to the peg would be written in Greek what was happening in the star signs and what you should be doing in the fields and what festivals you should be having, which I find is rather interesting because this is, in effect, a first ancient version of a spreadsheet. They didn't actually describe it as that, but I found it very interesting because it was the first ancient version of a spreadsheet. Then we come to going through that, some of the tribal views of time, and we come up to this very interesting point. You'll have to listen to it for a while. It's on page 105. Oh no, look, I've got 102. I've written it out in different orders. 102. The early culture, cultures didn't have so much a separate concept of time. They had a calendar or a sequence of ceremonies that you went through, which were triggered by stellar events or winds or rains and stuff like that. And so the early cultures, this is page 102, a little bit further back, these cultures didn't actually have a separate conceptualization of time. Sort of, you did one festival, and during the festival, you'd see something happening. And so this is what in science we would call confirmation bias. If we have a theory and we see something, we tend to say that confirms our theory. So if you do a ceremony for springtime, and then springtime comes, it cements your idea that your theory is correct. That's what we say in science. But they have a very interesting thing of the jaguar caterpillar people of Colombia. You've heard it correctly, caterpillar people. And you hear of jaguar people, you know, lion people, but caterpillar people. So what these people in Colombia used to do is follow the star sign of the caterpillar. They had a caterpillar they saw in the stars, obviously caterpillar shape, that walked to a part in the forest. And this part of the forest, when the caterpillar star sign rose, would start to rain caterpillars. Now, what in actual fact happened, we know from the outside that moths, migratory moths, migrate to this area, lay heaps and heaps of eggs, heaps and heaps of caterpillars, and it's caterpillar mania, and it starts to rain caterpillars. Now, for you and I think, oh, this would be unusual, but for these natives, this is a source of food just raining out of the sky. And so, I found that interesting, how the calendar and the events sort of stuck everyone together in society. Come to page 105, it starts looking at the Mursa, M-U-R-S-A people of southwestern Ethiopia. And they were in relative isolation, and there were anthropologists going through them in the 1960s and 70s. Unfortunately, this is more recent enough that these anthropologists will have had ethics committees and would know when they were studying a group, they were not to actually go and tell them their theory of time. They actually observed their theory of time. Now, what these this group had is they had it wasn't a person, but it was a sort of a concept called a Bergu, B-E-R-G-U, and it used to hang around every year, and it would age on a lunar month. Now, there are 12 lunar months and 11 days per cycle, per year cycle, and this means that they would watch for the crescent moon to see how old Bergu was. So Bergu would be 8, and then they would have an event which would happen after. After the Bergu is 8, there will be rains, and after the rains, you can do this. So they had a slightly more complex calendar, similar to the Indians of Colombia. The point was that obviously, from the outside, you'd know that running a few years, you'd have to actually add an extra Bergu. It would have to actually get to 13, or you'd have to do something to the numbers to make it right. And so what they found is that because no one had a fixed idea, it was a general community idea, and people would not really understand how it would go and come to a consensus. They'd have an argument, and they'd look for various other supporting signs, so it'd be a rather diffuse idea. So for me, this is, I think, a way people understand popular science at the moment. They don't really understand. They have an argument with people, and they have a consensus, and they walk away with a feeling that they do understand it. This slippage of the month, if you do understand it, your months therefore slip through the seasons, as you don't have enough months. Limiting your months to strictly 12 lunar months a year, you start to slip through the seasons. And this is what the Muslim calendar happens to the Muslim calendar, and it takes about 33 years for that slippage to be complete. 33 on 12 is very close to the slippage of your months there. And so Ramadan has a 33 cycle through the years. So for 33 years, it goes through slipping 11 days every year for Ramadan. But getting back to this place, the way that the Julian calendar solved it was that they'd introduce a new month every once in a while. The Babylonians had it more that the king would work out that things were not correct, and he would decree, sent throughout his kingdom in stone tablets, so it's very well recorded, decree an extra month. But here, this is only, you only get to this problem once you have people calculating things. And they just had a rather interesting episode where the anthropologist saw this person in the field and said, "What are you doing?" "Oh, well, I've worked out this way of solving this buku problem." Most people thought there was, "Look, there's no problem. Everyone just talks and agrees. It's a consensus way of doing things." So you've got the two engines of consensus and confirmation bias working together. And so this person said, "Look, I'm tying knots in this string and I'm counting up the number of days in a cycle, and then we'll be able to work things out." And so the anthropologist followed this hapless person around who had the correct answer or the correct first step, and everyone just poo-pooed him. They said, "Look, what do you need it for? We've got a perfectly good system of just asking half a dozen people. A few people say it's the 11th month, a few other people say it's the 10th month, and then there's a bit of an argument, and then we get the answer." So they sort of fumbled their way through it. So I found this rather interesting to look at this, because this is a snapshot of what happens with science in general. People come up with the new idea, but it's not necessary because we've got another method of doing science, which is this consensus, this feeling that we know the answer anyway, and people guess a number of likely answers and we pick the right answer. Sort of, it's like the real thinking engine embedded in sort of an unthinking society where the program has been the culture there. Getting back to the next section which piqued my interest was the Mayan or Aztec calendars, and they were quite sophisticated. They had a 365-day calendar and a 260-day calendar. The 260-day calendar came from sort of a bizarre understanding of their mathematics. Their mathematics was base 20, i.e. that so they had a number system which went from 0 to 20 in a series of a stroke for a 5 and a dot for a unit. And so rather than we having numbers from left to right, so the number to the right of 10, the 1 there means a unit of 10. For them, the units went up the page, and they used this system of numbering, which includes a stroke for 5, so 4 strokes would give you to 20. So you never drew 4 strokes, you always did a dot on the next page. It allowed you to the next line up. I won't go into that. You'd have to probably read it and research it yourself, the Aztec system. They eventually discovered what it was all about. But this meant that they had something base 20, and then they also had 13 for some reason. They picked 13, and so they had these two calendars which would run against each other, and these two calendars would run in circles around each other, meaning that no day was exactly the same. It's a very fascinating thing to look at. Of course, after 56 or 52 years, the calendars would start again, and of course this would create great confusion in the society. There'd be mass or large, all the fires were put out in the temples, and there was the problem that you had to put the fires out, as you do, and you have to do sacrifice a few people and take their heart out to get a new fire going. So that's for me is sort of the next step. You've got the Ethiopian guy trying to work it out. If he does work it out, society can just take it on and manipulate it. And so this ceremony is called the New Fire Ceremony. Just looking down here, page 136, started to go into the use of sundials, remembering back that the Egyptians' sundial produced that you divide your day into 12 hours strictly. So dawn was always at 6 a.m. It was, that sorted a whole lot of things out. Sort of meant that all the medieval prayers were before and after dawn and associated with it. So it made a rather complicated place, but if everyone had a sundial, it was great. And so here, as people got sundials, my sundial's better than your sundial, so rich people had these gilt sundials in multiple boxes and with lots of useful information about it, sort of almost like a little Michelin guide for around the place, because pilgrims needed a sundial to work out where it was going. So it was great sundial makers, of the highest class sundial makers. Now, to remember, basically, a sundial is, in its simplest form, a stick in the ground, but here you had these little rings with holes in it and would go to inscriptions, and the wealthy would have these golden inscribed sundials in multiple boxes. And, of course, what I loved is the fact is that as soon as this happened, there was a rip-off industry. And it's sort of like they had the Rolex of sundials and you had the Rolex rip-offs, and people could be sold a rip-off sundial. It wasn't as good as the real sundial. It was a rip-off. So but you can imagine them if the medieval people went to Thailand for a holiday, they'd be obviously sold. Someone with walked up to the beach here. But I don't think that actually happened. So I rather like that aspect, that the human nature that we see today goes through. 146. I've actually skipped one here. I wanted to do Captain Cook. Captain Cook is something I'll get back to. This is going back to native people. This is the Jaguar people and the Newfour Aztecs and all these types of people. Captain Cook's in that area, page 110, of these cultures. And of course, these cultures have actually lived their calendar. So their calendar wasn't written down. They actually worked their way through. You can imagine a cultural calendar in three dimensions, and their society lurched their way through it. So the Hawaiians had Captain Cook went around the world several times, famous British sailor. I'll probably give you a bit of people in America and Russia listening to this, a bit of information about this. But Captain Cook went to Hawaii. First time he went on the Festival of Lono. This is the real upbeat, everything can happen, new things are happening festival in their calendar. And when he came along, they said, confirmation about us. He was confirmation of their existing set of beliefs. And so he was exalted, giving a great, great time. And then he went around and then came back a bit later. Things weren't as rosy because their society had moved on to another culture, another calendar area where things were gloomy. And so he came back and basically got killed. The ability, which for me is really interesting because depending on this consensus and confirmation bias, it comes together and gives different behaviour of society, which within society seems perfectly reasonable. And the irony of Captain Cook and this not understanding time for another culture is just so amazing. So Captain Cook himself, his voyage was to check the new British super secret weapon, which was accurate clocks. And he was going to do sort of a time super thing with time. So he went to observe an eclipse. Now, an eclipse I suppose the moon, not so much Venus, local eclipses give a very accurate time because the eclipses happen at the same time throughout the planet. If you see an eclipse, you can observe it and get an exact time because that's calculated by a different method. You can advance calculator. And so Cook was really into time, but he just wasn't into working out what the Hawaiians were doing. So we've done sundials, Aztecs, 46. So I want to do Columbus. This is Columbus, the person, the Italian person who courted Spanish money and sailed off to Americas, and he had a sort of a startup idea that he'd be able to sail straight across from Europe, straight avoiding it. So the interesting thing is that Columbus didn't believe in America. That's the one thing. It's just the most amazing thing. He discovered America, but he actually didn't believe it was there. He believed that he was actually traveling to the West Indies, which is Indonesia, that area like that. And so when he saw the Native Americans, he called them Indians and stuff like that. But the major thing was that he had to reckon how fast he was traveling on his boat. So he would, when he was sailing his boat, I can't remember the name of the boat, you Americans will, 1492 or whatever it is, I can't remember what the date, you have a saying over there. And so he'd observe it, and being a very an optimistic entrepreneur, he overestimated his speed. Now his crew, who were concerned about going too far, too fast, he would then underestimate the distance. So he got his speed, overestimated, calculated his real distance, and himself kept a position where he really thought he was, and then underestimated to report to his crew, who had become very more ruxious, more nervous the further they got away from Europe. So he really thought he was actually traversing not only the Atlantic, America, and Pacific. That's how much he overestimated it. When he got back, his underestimation of his overestimation was, in fact, accurate. So I sort of rather like that, sort of two estimations working against each other. We come up to page 170, which starts to go with the fact that once we've got mechanical clocks, there's so much interesting stuff here. Once we've got mechanical clocks, sundials became firstly, the sundials had to be recalibrated to break up the hours such that there were 24 equal hours in a day. That's pretty amazing. So the mechanical clocks, but it also meant that the sundials had meant that the time was midday when the sun was highest at your location. So you'd be in one village, the next village over would have a slightly different time. In fact, wherever you set a sundial up, that was midday. So you could have midday at different times at different places. And so this obviously was the dominant paradigm. This is way up into the Victorian era. So you had trains travelling. And what they did is they had to manage this. And at this stage, sundials were at the top. So what they did is for trains from the west travelling eastward, they would have a, I suppose it would be a fast running clock. Yeah, a fast running clock. And trains travelling the other way, they'd put a clock which is running slow. So The clocks would be dreadful. They wouldn't get the right time, but they'd start to get the right time as they went to the stations, because this is how they dealt with the time limit. They actually got their clocks and deliberately made them slow or fast to go with time, the time. And of course, with the invention of telegraph, people were able to telegraph the time to everybody, and it started getting the standardization of time. And eventually in the United States, they worked together, and this is not in the book, but they had the different counties, and the railways really forced this, and the mechanical clocks, the standardization of time. So getting up to there, we've got Piaget in page 128, and this corresponds to Piaget was an educationalist, and it was people's conception of time, and we have the mechanical conception of time. And our ability, I've forgotten what the actual term is, centrate. That is, if you don't understand too many, if you only understand a couple concepts, you just focus on one concept and that's enough to get across, which for me sort of really describes sort of non-scientist people getting into things. They sort of focus on one aspect and they get intellectually exhausted by the time they look at one thing. So Piaget, they had this stages of children's learning. So very famously, children do not have a theory of mind early on. They do not know that people cannot tell what you are thinking. They think that if I feel everyone can think it, they don't think that other people have theories of mind. And eventually they have to be, children have to be around 11 or 12 before they start thinking in an abstract way. They think in a very concrete way. I find my children have always thought very, very abstractly. Now, what's interesting here is, so this centration means the way you judge time depends on your intellect a little bit, or the child's intellect. There also, there's a way of judging time in terms of the amount of things that are happening, and how you perceive those things are happening. So if you don't understand something, you have to store events happening, because the whole series of events, and you can get a feeling that things are taking longer if you don't, this sort of makes sense, if you don't understand it, and that this is your an accumulation of events in your mind. And so this is a very interesting thing. All I can say is I found it interesting. Please read page 218. Getting back a bit earlier, 207 was Hogland from 1930. This is the last thing of the book. So the things that really interest me is where you've got history, the famous scientists, you can read it into it, but it's the odd people who just get a footnote and they're going off and you see them for a moment and you can think of their time before, during and after. So for this Ethiopian tribe man who suddenly thought, look, we can count our way through the calendars, and being poo-pooed, even though there are thousands of people before him which have actually successfully got that up. My heart went out to him. I thought, you know, look, I 100% understand someone coming up with a scientific idea and it being poo-pooed by society. Hogland was a scientist, and it's sort of very interesting, having read the book. His poor wife had the flu, and what happened is that he went away for a fixed amount of time on his clock. His wife berated him for being away for so long. And he said, I have a theory. I think the rate at which you think time passes slows down, if that makes sense, you think time passes more slowly, or the same amount of time you judge as longer, the higher your temperature. And so his poor wife was subjected to heaps of measurements. He'd take his temperature and get her to count times and do all these time counting things. And indeed, this is where people began to pick up a general model that if you're hot, time passes more slowly in your event register. Now, so this is interesting because you've got this psychological, you've got the mechanical time, the actual physical time, and the psychological time, and the psychological time is temperature dependent, yet your biological time, which is covered very early in the book, is set by a little group of nerve cells, a tiny little button in your brain called the supra charismatic nucleus. I love that. But it's a little thing which sticks above your optic nerve. And so if you see light, this it gets reset, but that's your circadian rhythm. That's set by very much the day length or the light vision. So this is the going to the idea of having not seeing too much screen time at night, and just the overall way that your body clock is set. So this was interesting from two aspects. One is that this person thought, hang on, oh my sick, that's an excellent investigation method. I'll look into it. And the other aspect is that although it's been established that the rhythm in the biological world is fairly temperature independent, so you can have a cold snap and a hot snap, and the temperature can vary fairly wildly, but overall spring will start on cue because it's clocking, it's looking at the light, it's not looking at the temperature. Whereas in terms of our world where we're concentrating all the time, it is temperature dependent, so I rather like that. So my overall thing is, as a scientist, you just don't get to talk about these things in depth, and I'd hate to shudder to think it's 32 minutes. I won't take too long. Sorry, guys, if this is too long. I find that people... I find it really interesting. I speak to people, and have they read the book? Yes, they have. They do recall different things, but they don't sort of really process it. I haven't worked out what that is. I suppose in terms of a book review, it's sort of really hard to go across. The other aspect is that people don't have sort of connective knowledge to look at a book, so a non-fiction book, and say, oh, what aspects have they left out? So this is the second bit. The first bit was where I reviewed the book. The second bit is where I reflected and saying, sort of looking a bit at myself and saying, how do you hold this knowledge and how do you write it down and how do you approach it? And, how do other people read books? And I, for some reason, they don't seem to really go through, or the people that I know really go through it and nitpick it. They quickly get bored if you try and actually talk about a particular aspect of it. I have actually done a podcast on the Chinese sex clock, which coordinated. So there may be some interest in some sort of tidbit, sort of advertisement, but there's no deep discussion of it. This actually gets to me, as I read it, there were things that struck me which were missing. So this is the third bit, is where I just go through a whole series of points which you may find interesting. And now, the science, so we've gone with the Gregorian calendar from the, I suppose, late Renaissance. That's gradually spread throughout the world. And that's an intercalculation calendar where you add leap years in a particular way. And of course, science can't actually handle that because science has a defined second. So we've it's, it is interesting in terms of that science has been sort of the trash heap of concepts that people have become aware of and have used and they go into, but they can't really tell people that they're using when they go back into society. So science itself is stuck with the Julian calendar, which is a fixed number of days, and to be precise, they've got the scientific year is 365.25 days a year of defined, and it's got a defined second, so the Earth actually travels a different speed this year. So the science year is different, and we don't use the science year for the historical purposes, but we do use it for calculating things like a light year. So if the Earth should slow down, our distances, we should go to a closer orbit and or more quickly, or as we will do, go to a slightly larger orbit and orbit more slowly as the tidal effects slow us down and we tidally lock. I suppose we're going to have to tidally lock with the sun. We'll go to a slightly longer year. but getting back to it. So we have a mathematical year, and that's the end of it. So a year is just like a number, like a dozen. A year is a certain amount of time, and we use it to get light years, and a light year is a very fixed distance. It's a certain number of seconds, and that's how far a light year is, the distance travelled in so many a year's worth of seconds, and a year's worth of seconds is like a dozen or a million a year. So that's the way that we do it. I've written down here, it's of another really important thing about year, is that the length of the day has changed, and it sort of had stuck. So we know that there used to be 400 days a year, because we can see the daily ring growth on these very early life forms, and see it go through a day cycle and an annual cycle, and we count the number of days in a year, that's around 400. So when life started off, kicked off, became multicellular around 600 million years ago, these are the first life forms, they recorded the length of the year, the length of the day, and that was 21 hours. What happens is that the moon, as the moon slowly orbits further away from us, orbits further away from us as it's actually spun out. It spins further out, taking the rotational energy of the Earth with it as it does. So when the moon was first formed, our day was very short, say 6 hours. By the time life emerged, it was 21 hours. It's gone to 24 now. And now the interesting thing here, and this is not covered by the book, so don't read the book for it. The actual lengthening of the year of time is a complex. So the lengthening of the day, the number of hours in a day. All right. So the Egyptians would have no problems because they would go back and say, well, it's 24 by definition. But now we've gone into science, we can now say the length of the hour, the length of the day was much shorter at times. Now, there's a whole lot of other things swirling around the Earth or equilibrating to keep the Earth spinning fast. So if the Earth's spinning fast, the moon can move further away and take the spin out of different places. So this is namely the atmosphere and tides and other things happening within the Earth. Just incidentally, the core of the Earth is spinning at a different rate to the crust of the Earth. We can go into that. So we now know the core of the Earth, and the reason that we can tell the core of the Earth is the core of the Earth is a single nickel and iron solid sphere, it's single crystal, and so we can actually see the Earth's core rotate by seeing the speed of sound change, move around as the crystal in the center of the Earth moves. Now you may find this a bit mind-blowing, but it is all true. Just, I suppose, go to Wikipedia, ask scientists, ask geologists about it, and they're very careful. Oh, I suppose careful not to upset too many people, but do ask about it. So the center of the Earth, the surface of our core is 5,000 degrees, which is the same temperature as the surface of our sun. And I'll eventually get into describing how the surface of the sun. So that's an interesting aspect that the missed by the book, that the actual days are changing, the length of time is changing. I suppose it's not really in their purview. It's they're looking about the society's discovery of time. Now, one of the things I wanted to get into is that there's this sort of times at which the two different calendars, the Julian and Gregorian calendar, come to a clash, and people, most people know about the September revolution, which happened in October. This is the Russian Revolution. The Russians had a different calendar, and but I suppose the most historic thing happened where the calendars actually changed history. The calendars record history is Austerlitz, when Napoleon turned up, and the Russian and Prussian armies were going to unite together and give Napoleon a lesson. And of course, what happened is that the Russians turned up at a date, but their calendar was slow, so they turned up several days late to be beaten a second time. So there was two phases to the Battle of Austerlitz, helped by a calendar mistake. So I find that interesting. Yeah, but one of the things I want to go in is Galileo. Oh, let's do Drake first. So Drake was an English sailor. He was sort of Queen Elizabeth I around that time, Renaissance. And he circumnavigated. I'm going to have to check the time so I don't. Oh, look, I'm going to have to stop this. I'll give you another wrap-up podcast. I've got to go off and pick up my son. So thanks for listening, and I'll pick up in the next podcast, probably on this, about Drake, Galileo, Richter, how old the Earth is, lasers, and... oh, yes, and a bit of general relativity. Also, antimatter time going backwards. I'll pick that up on the next podcast. Bye for now. Thanks for listening.